book is a member of the Witness to History series. It is entitled The Tragic Truth About the FDR Era, Volume A, FDR's Rise to the Presidency. It was recorded on February 11, 1976, by Colonel Curtis B. Dowell and Dr. Peter Beter. Colonel Dowell shares with Dr. Beter and with you rare and often stunning personal close-ups of the personality, family, and presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was Colonel Dowell's father-in-law. He also draws upon the lessons of a remarkable business career, ranging from the top echelons of Wall Street, where, for example, he was once a partner in the firm known today as Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, to the founding of what is today one of America's best-known major companies. His accomplishments are rendered even more amazing by the fact that he served a total of more than 13 years in voluntary military service, leading to the rank he now holds in the retired Air Force Reserve. He is also the author of several books, including FDR, My Exploited Father-in-Law, and Warlords of Washington, and is well known for his patriotic activities, for which he has been honored with a number of awards. He is joined in this discussion by Dr. Peter Beter, who is no stranger to audiobook listeners. Dr. Beter has recorded 4 previous audiobook talking tapes and is heard monthly throughout the United States and in several foreign countries by means of his unique monthly audio letter. He is widely known as the man who opened Fort Knox in 1974, as well as for his numerous advanced revelations of major economic and political developments based on confidential information sources in intelligence, business, and finance. He is listed in Who's Who in the East and other biographical reference works, and has written several books, including the nonfiction bestseller, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, published by George Braziller in 1973.
Colonel Dowell, it's indeed an honor to be here with you today to discuss one of the most important topics in the history of the United States, the role of your father-in-law, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and his impact on the present as well as the past and future course of our nation. In our discussion today, February 11, 1976, I believe our listeners should be given a personal evaluation of the significance of the Roosevelt era. And as you know, it has been virtually impossible to have this evaluation because the data has been carefully hidden in family records and hasn't been made available for the general public. Since you were a part of this Roosevelt Delano family, we are indeed privileged to be able to record today an oral history of a very important part of the history of our nation.
Dr. Beter, I appreciate very much the opportunity of exchanging ideas on very important topics with you. I am flattered that you want to ask my personal opinions, most of which I have never discussed before with the public. But I feel that in our challenging days, which are upon us here, it is important for the American people to understand some of the problems which they have not effectively understood or solved in the past, and I am very delighted to have this opportunity to exchange ideas with you this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much, Colonel. I know there are those apologists of the New Deal who will ask, why bring up the New Deal at this time? After all, it's been dead for so many years. But the point is, it's not dead. We are about to see it resurrected by Nelson Rockefeller, one of the original key New Dealers, and only he will call it by another name very shortly, the New Balance, or some sort of euphemistic name. On the topic of FDR, the American public falls into two large groups. There are those who consider him a hero, a savior, if you please, and then there are those who strongly dislike him as being deceptive, treacherous, dishonest, and serving his own personal interests. I think that the best way we can begin is to ask, how did you first come to know FDR?
Dr. Beter, I first heard about FDR in an article, at which time he was running for vice president with Mr. Cox as president on the Democratic ticket in 1920. And I recall seeing a picture of him standing there with a rifle in his hand. For what purpose, I do not know, because he had a stiff collar on and a stick pin in his tie. And I couldn't figure out, but somebody said, well, Mr. Roosevelt, you've got to get some sort of a gimmick to make you a little folksy. That's the first time I ever even heard of his name, but I got to know him later on, as I will develop with you in due course.
Well, then getting to the lady that you married, Anna, the daughter, when did you first meet her, Colonel?
Well, Dr. Peter, I met Anna at a dinner party at the home of friends of mine, Mr. and Mrs. Walter Douglas, in their Fifth Avenue home in New York in 1924, around Christmas time, before a dance. And Anna and Kay Douglas, the daughter of Walter Douglas, who was then the president of the Southern Pacific Railway, they were classmates or schoolmates at Miss Chapin's school. And at the dance, I enjoyed later on, and one thing led to another, and then I was invited to a house party at Anna's grandmother's, Mrs. James Roosevelt's home in Hyde Park, and we had a very nice weekend up there, and several months later, we became engaged, and following June, we were married.
Well,
at Hyde Park.
But had you not met FDR before that?
No, I had not, Dr. Peter.
I see, and
met him up there at his mother's home when he came to dinner in a wheelchair. I was rather touched by his appearance because his eyes were wistful and he had to be wheeled in by an attendant. He joined in the conversation and I immediately became attached to him and I was quite touched by his courage in trying to overcome his disability. When I went to see him about a couple of months later at his office in the Fidelity Deposit Company for luncheon, I was impressed with all the naval pictures that he had around his desk, and he had our luncheon brought in on a tray by a waiter, and we discussed World War I, and I told him that I had been a very unimportant ensign in the naval aviation forces overseas, but I had volunteered, and he asked me a lot of questions because I had served under an old friend of his, Zachary Lansdowne, who was then a commander at the forces at Guipavar. And I had served prior to the armistice with the Royal Naval Forces at Howden, East Yorkshire, in their balloon forces. We had a patrol in the North Sea. And he asked me a lot of questions, and we got along fine.
Do you recall, Colonel, some of the questions that FDR asked you at that time?
Well, not very many, Dr. Beter. It was largely, small talk about his going overseas at that time with Woodrow Wilson and the George Washington and the peace conference at Versailles. And he asked me if I had seen Commander Lansdowne recently, and I said no, I hadn't. And unfortunately, the commander was burned up in that terrible accident at the Shenandoah.
Did he ever work in Wall Street, Colonel?
Well, Wall Street, Dr. Beter, is a general term. He was a vice president of the Fidelity Deposit Company, which is the big casualty insurance company with its main office in Baltimore, Maryland. And he was, from a titular point of view, he was in charge of their New York office. But due to his physical condition, he only went there occasionally, but his name was very valuable in the bonding business. And he used to go down to Wall Street occasionally, I would say. But prior to his getting the attack of infantile paralysis that happened, he used to go down there. And he was interested in law more than finance. But he became involved in several deals down there, and several of which I didn't think very much of.
Was he a good stockman or a good stock dealer?
No, I would say absolutely not. FDR's knowledge on money was very limited. Very limited indeed. But he had a good law background, and I presume that he could write a pretty good legal paper, although I think he's sloughed off most of this to his partners.
As I understand it, he didn't like law. He liked to create law, work on law, and create it, but never follow the law.
Or perhaps manufacture his own law in political areas if the case warranted.
Because later on, when he did become president, he was always very happy when he signed legislation. He said to the effect, now I'm creating law.
That's right. I think he remembered the maxim that we could apply to Louis XIV, l'état, c'est moi.
Translating, Colonel, meaning the state is me.
That's right. It's an exaggerated form of egotism.
Are you saying that FDR was an egotist?
Extremely so, Dr. Beter.
I see. Now, I noticed that you bowed out of the family in the summer of 1933. Can you tell us why that was?
Well, that's a lot of things happened, Dr. Beter, between 1924 and 1933. Historically, politically, economically, in this country, you remember that we had the initiation of an enormous panic in the fall of 1929, where a lot of us in Wall Street lost a great deal of money. And we had the political rise at the same time, coincidentally, with the rise of FDR at that time, at the suggestion of Al Smith and some of his associates to have him run for governor, which he did and was elected. And from that time on, his star as a political figure rose. And my situation in Wall Street reflected the devastation and the decline and the panic prices that the panic wrought upon us, which is duly inflicted upon us by international interests. So when FDR moved on down to Washington, things changed, and some of his associates, very high associates and friends, like Louis McHenry Howe and Felix Frankfurter, who didn't particularly like me, it caused a parting of the ways, and unfortunate, I think, that the situation occurred because I did not go along with some of the things that I saw in the White House at very close range.
So then, after that, you only came back to the White House on weekends.
That's about right. I was very busy in Wall Street during the week, and I'd run down to Washington to see my two children, Sister and Buzz, and visit with friends and talk to the president occasionally, and then I'd go back to New York on Sunday night.
Right, and in June 1933, I think you got your divorce, or at least...
Anna went to Reno in June of 33, and with Katie and Sister and Buzz, I went up to visit my very good old friends, Willis Wilmot and his mother and father, at Plum Lake, Wisconsin. We were up there for about 6 weeks. And in the meantime, I recall that I felt I should like to have a pistol permit because it's a kind of rough country, and the late J. Edgar Hoover personally gave me a pistol permit. But Charlie Rich went along with him, with us at that time, and he was a member of the FBI that helped me out, too, just in case.
What is your present situation so far as your marriage and your children? And I know that you're a grandfather, and you do have children from Anna Roosevelt. What is that situation today?
Well, Sister and Buzz, of course, have grown up and out in the wide world, and after Anna and I parted company very gently, about 6 years later, I married Catherine Miller Lees of Haverford, Pennsylvania, and we have four children, and we have four grandchildren, which I'm very proud of. And we see them occasionally here, or not as often as we would like.
Going back to our earlier conversations, Colonel, can you tell us about the time when you bowed out as a member of the family? Could you expound more on that?
Well, I think I know what you're driving at, Dr. Beter. Yes, I always maintained very friendly relationship with FDR, and he with me for very valid reasons. We were always good friends, although I did not agree with a number of his political observations and leanings. But I will say this, that his mother thought very well of me, and I was still one of her three trustees, along with his uncle, Mr. Frederick A. Delano, and himself, and so we had reasons to be close friends, but I was so shocked that I can hardly describe it when I found out later on of his role in bringing on World War II and the Pearl Harbor attack. That was really devastating to me.
Did you get any hint of any change in the character of FDR?
Oh, I think that's a very interesting question. Yes, I certainly did, because he was a certain type of individual. He's ambitious to do something better. But when he did arrive at that point, and you must remember that he was crippled, he became difficult in this respect. He was not only ambitious, very vain, but he was completely handled on important things of international monetary matters and important social matters by his advisors. So actually, he was a perfect foil for them, and that was very dismaying to me, having known him in brighter years, brighter former years.
Did they try to build him up and say, you should be the president of the world, if I may say?
I think that idea was thrown out to him that if he did thus and so, if he created another war and they got into an international situation, he was a logical man, certainly not Winston Churchill or anybody in Europe. He was a logical man to be the first president of the world, and I think that flattered his vanity.
Colonel, I can't help but feel that we have another scenario here in Woodrow Wilson. In that they were telling Wilson, too, in those days, that he was going to be the great white father on the great white horse to save the world. You remember those principles?
Yes, I sure do. I think that's a good point. Woodrow Wilson was the tool of the international bankers and the international ideologists, and so was FDR. There was a great deal of similarity between the two of them. Of course, the internationalists had made a great deal of money from the period of World War I, out of World War I, up into World War II, so it was a very much more serious situation and more valuable to them when FDR was put into the White House by them.
I see another link from Woodrow Wilson to President Roosevelt and to Nelson Rockefeller when he becomes president, if he does become president under his scenario, and if he does become president under his new balance. We've had the New Deal, the Fair Deal. Now we're going to have the new balance, and I understand he's going to start really campaigning on February the 19th at opening a gun here in Washington at the National Press Club, and he's going to speak on some very controversial subjects. It seems now that the member of this international tribe is now going to come forth. This is their third attempt. This is their third time at bat. And if he makes a home run, it seems to me that the American people are out.
Or what?
Are out. That is, the American people are going to suffer. They are now going to get their merging of American life into that of the Soviet Union. Now, I'm trying to set the stage here, Colonel, very quickly so that we can go into more substance later on, as if we haven't had enough substance so far. We have. We want to get your opinions on really the things that took place during this period. It's a very important period, and also to pierce the veil that many of the American people have not been able to do for so many years, because you were an intimate part of this family. And speaking of the family again, could you tell us a little bit about Eleanor Roosevelt, who you refer to in your book as Mama?
As Mama, I called her. And she was a very interesting, colorful lady, as you well know. At the time when I first knew her, though, she was very quiet, and she was in the background largely at her mother-in-law's house at Hyde Park. But she was a very gracious hostess and helped her mother-in-law and her husband. She wanted him to retain his political status at that time and maintain his many friends, whereas his mother, Mrs. James Roosevelt, who I will in the future refer to in this interview as Granny, She wanted her son to take it easy and retire and lead the life of a country gentleman in his semi-crippled condition. She had a very old, fine old Hudson River estate there, and her house had been remodeled. And they had a very large, great room added on one end, which is very colorful, full of books, and a very big fireplace. And FDR had a desk to the left of that fireplace, which was the desk, I believe, that Wilson used on the George Washington when he went abroad. I can remember one time when we were talking there, and we were looking at this picture over that hung over the fireplace there. It was a picture of Isaac Roosevelt. And he was in semi-colonial garb, very interesting, and I was looking at it, and he was looking at it, too. And he says, "Kurt, you know, that old boy was a pretty sharp tack." And I said, "Yes, I guess he was." He said, "If you and I were to do any business with him, he certainly ought to have kept our overcoats or coat buttoned." And he laughed, and I thought that was a pretty good joke about it, one of his ancestors.
Were there any close neighbors of importance around Granny's estate, Colonel?
Well, I say, Dr. Vina, she was surrounded by very important neighbors. In particular, I can refer to the Archibald Rogers. Mr. Rogers was one of the original members of the Standard Oil Group, and he gave many a fine New Year's Eve party. I attended several, and we used to play hockey on his ice pond.
When you lived near the estate of Pocantico Hills, where the Rockefellers lived, did you ever have occasion to see Nelson Rockefeller?
Oh, yes, we were good friends, and we were friends of his family there, and occasionally I would go over there and play tennis with him. And I recall one time when we were playing tennis, and then we were invited, Anna and I were invited for dinner at his grandfather's house. That was were about 14 people, as I remember it, and his grandfather was a most interesting gentleman. He was in up in years, but he had a most alert look. His eyes had a very piercing look, and he was extremely bright, I would say. For some reason or other, I don't know, but I was sitting on his right during the dinner, and at the close of the dinner, we played a little game, which was Mr. Rockefeller's favorite game called Numerica.
That's an unusual name. Could you tell us about that game?
And it was a very, very simple little numbers game, something like bingo. And at the conclusion of the game, the butler came in and carried out the little cards. And I turned to Mr. Rockefeller and said, "Mr. Rockefeller, this is a very, very interesting game. Very interesting indeed." He smiled at me and cleared his throat, sort of like that. And everybody, of course, stopped talking. And down on the other end of the table was his housekeeper, Mrs. Evans, a very attractive lady, up in years, but she looked after the old gentleman. And he cleared his throat, sort of, everybody stopped talking, and he said, "Yes, Mr. Dow, Numerica is a very, very interesting and very fine game. The fine points of which I learned as a small boy at the knee of Mrs. Evans." And everybody roared with laughter because that made her out to be about 150 years old. It was a very interesting dinner, I can assure you that.
Getting back to the political phase, Colonel, can you tell us when FDR began to get back into the political arena?
I would say that about 1927, Dr. Beter. His health was improving in respect to the movement of his legs, and his wife was very active in helping him rebuild his fences politically. And Al Smith came into the picture, and together with Al Smith and some of his friends, why, he not only helped Al Smith, but in turn Al Smith helped him. And I would say that's where the political star of FDR began to arise, about 1927 to 1928, and then FDR was finally elected governor of New York State.
Did Granny and Eleanor, his wife, have any part of this?
Well, his wife did, but Granny didn't enter into it very much, except that she entertained some of the many people that came at her house. And sometimes she was a little upset when there'd be 20 people for dinner, and she didn't know anything except there was going to be 6.
So did she take to politics as such?
Or no, she wasn't particularly fond of politics, but her daughter-in-law, Eleanor Roosevelt, was, and she was a very gracious and very, very real help to FDR at that time.
You once told me a story about Al Smith and his platoon. Would you share it with our listeners?
Dr. Beeler, that's a funny story, really, in serious politics. Al Smith was coming from Albany on his way to New York, and Al was governor at that time. And he was stopped off to see Franklin for luncheon at Granny's house at Hyde Park on the way to New York. And Al Smith used to chew a cigar down to the butt, and he'd use a spittoon a lot. And when Granny didn't have a spittoon, a big brass spittoon in her big living room. So the problem came is, what are we going to do when Al Smith gets down to the end of his cigar? Well, Tom Lynch, who was quite a politician in Poughkeepsie, solved the problem, and he came up with a very bright, shiny spittoon there, and that solved and saved the day, so Al Smith and nobody else was embarrassed.
Colonel, what was it like to be around FDR during the days when he was governor in Albany, New York?
Well, Dr. Beeler, I only went up there occasionally because we had plenty going on Wall Street. We were at the bottom of a depression there. But the executive house in those days at Albany was very grim and very gloomy. FDR had to have a special elevator put in there so he could get up and down. And I never particularly enjoyed going up to Albany on account of those circumstances.
I see, but what was the atmosphere around there during the days of the stock market crash?
Were in Wall Street?
No, there at Albany.
Well, they didn't reflect that very much, so they were largely engrossed in the political aspects of the situation.
Do you think that the plans were laid during that time for President Roosevelt to become president?
A little bit later on, I would say, this is a guess, I would say about 1929. And 30. I think at that time some of the important people in New York began to feel that FDR was a potential candidate, and I further feel that he went along with some of their major objectives, and I mentioned people like John Raskob, Al Smith, Bernard Baruch, Felix Frankfurter, Joe Kennedy, and others.